Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. At the close of another week under the cloud of the pandemic, the White House announces a new mask policy, and a fearful U.S. watches as the death toll ticks up. We speak with leading health official Dr. Anthony Fauci on the latest medical guidance.
More and more accumulation of data indicate that people who are without symptoms at all can transmit the virus, but importantly, they can do it merely by speaking.
Then we continue our look at medical workers on the front lines as retired doctors and medical students are taking up the call. And it's Friday. Mark Shields and David Brooks analyze the reaction from Washington and around the country as COVID-19 extends its reach to all aspects of American life. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The United States heads into this weekend with coronavirus deaths still accelerating. The pandemic has now claimed some 7,000 lives nationwide. And there is new guidance tonight on using face masks. But President Trump says he has no plans to wear one. More than 40% of the deaths are in New York. And the governor says the state will start seizing vital medical equipment. Meanwhile, new numbers confirm that the American job market is collapsing. Amna Nawaz begins our coverage.
For many Americans, Friday is payday, but not so today. As stores remain closed, restaurants dark, and parking lots empty, all markers of an economy reeling through a global pandemic. The Labor Department reported today that employers shed more than 700,000 jobs last month. Top White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow warned of what's yet to come.
It's going to get worse in the weeks ahead. There's no question about it. The effects of the pandemic and the mitigation that's required to end it are taking a huge toll.
COVID-19 continues to take a toll on the U.S. health system. The week saw an expansion of stay-at-home orders in the U.S., putting a majority of Americans across 38 states under some sort of directive. Massachusetts today saw its biggest one-day jump in both new cases and deaths. Total cases now top 10,400 and more than 190 have died. Governor Charlie Baker.
Our models suggest cases are likely to increase rapidly in the coming weeks, and the strain on our healthcare system will be unprecedented.
At the country's epicenter in New York, cases reached over 102,000 today, and deaths reached over 2,900, after the biggest single-day increase so far. Hospitals past capacity are transferring patients to makeshift clinics at the convention center and even parts of Central Park. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo railed against the procurement process, which pits state against state, and called for more coordination at the federal level.
It is unbelievable to me that in New York State, in the United States of America, we can't make these materials. New York is in crisis. Help New York. And then pick up, decamp, and then go to the next place as this rolls across the country.
Cuomo today signed an aggressive new order authorizing seizure of unused ventilators and PPE from private hospitals and companies.
If they want to sue me for borrowing their excess ventilators to save lives, let them sue me.
But even resources intended to alleviate the system strain are getting stuck in bureaucratic knots. The U.S. Navy ship Comfort and its 1,000 hospital beds was meant to help New York treat non-COVID-19 patients. So far, they've bunked barely 20. The same is true aboard the Mercy ship in Los Angeles, where fewer than 10 patients have been treated. The Defense Department today announced a screening process change to allow more patients to come their way. From the Supreme Court today, a change in plans, saying it's postponing oral arguments scheduled for the end of April. And from the White House, a change in guidance on masks. White House health officials joined cities like Los Angeles and New York, recommending people wear cloth face masks even if they show no COVID-19 symptoms. Those measures have long been used by countries in Asia and Europe as they worked to stop the virus's spread. In Spain today, the death toll surpassed Italy's, topping 11,000. As hospitals overflow, these ice rinks remain as makeshift morgues. And safeguards to contain the virus also remain in place, as at this nursing home in Santa Coloma, where this is the only way for Maria Espinar to check on her mother.
Now they said that they are going to test all the residents that are well, and if they are negative, they will let you take them home. But of course, the problem is that I don't know if I'm infected. How will I take her home?
More uncertainty in Saudi Arabia, where for the first time in modern history, officials say the annual Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca, the Hajj, could be postponed. Some 2 million Muslims have been asked to hold off on travel plans by the Saudi government.
The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is prepared to secure the safety of all Muslims and nationals. That's why we have requested from all Muslims around the world to hold on to signing any agreements until we have a clear vision.
The latest in major global events to come to a standstill while the virus continues its march around the world. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Amna Nawaz.
As the spread of COVID-19 has increased, there have been significant new questions about stay-at-home orders, whether the public should be wearing masks outside, and new findings about how the virus spreads. I spoke this afternoon with one of the government's top officials on the public health response, Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institutes of Health. He's a key member of the president's coronavirus task force. And we spoke before the president announced the recommendation from the CDC that people use a cloth or fabric mask outside. Dr. Fauci, thank you very much for joining us. You are now saying that you don't understand why all Americans are not staying at home. Have you told the president that you think it's a good idea to order Americans to stay home?
Well, there's always that difficulty of ordering centrally versus having the states be the major implementers of policy. I have said that I feel we should be implementing this social distancing or physical separation, which in many respects means staying at home to the extent possible. And I do think we should do it broadly throughout the country, because although there are hot spots that we see that are very obvious, there is the threat of outbreak virtually everywhere and anywhere within our country. So when we extended the guidelines from the 15-day guidelines to now 30 days towards the end of April, I think this is an opportunity for everyone, every state, every region, every locale, to participate in this very serious physical separation as delineated very clearly in the guidelines. I have articulated this multiple times, as have several of my other colleagues. I'm not alone on this. And we daily brief the president.
But when lives are at stake, why aren't command measures requiring people to do this appropriate now?
You know, I think if you look at the utterances at the press conference, when you hear me and others and the vice president and the president speak, it really is the functionally equivalent of that. I understand what you're talking about, Judy, about making a very explicit statement, but that generally is not the way things operate in the relationship between the federal government and the states. I mean, I say out there to all who are listening in all the states that they should be doing this, even though they feel that in certain respects, there are relatively few cases in their city, in their town, in their state. That will change. There is no region in the country, in my mind, that's going to be exempt from an outbreak if you do not do the appropriate mitigation issues, namely the physical separations that are clearly spelled out in the guidelines.
But let me ask you, for those people who are mostly staying at home, but they are going to the grocery store or to the pharmacy or taking a walk, that those guidelines are still appropriate?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The guidelines that, you know, you often at the press conference, the vice president puts up that card where he talks about the guidelines and, you know, 30 days to do this now with the extension. They're all spelled out pretty clearly there. And I think, I know there's disparity throughout the country, because you look at some of the videos and some of the information you get, and there is disparities. There are still people who are not abiding by that. And I would just use my presence here on your program to plead with them to please take seriously those guidelines.
masks. We are told that the Trump administration is on the verge of urging Americans to wear masks when they go out. Tell us about the thinking on that, because just a few days ago, we were told that the thinking was it was not necessary.
It's a great question, Judy. And the thinking is really now influenced by information that's coming in. And the information is that more and more accumulation of data indicate that people who are without symptoms at all can transmit the virus. But importantly, they can do it merely by speaking. So there's been a recent study that came out that said even the force from your voice of speaking, there is a degree of aerosolization, namely the virus can come out not very far, a few feet and down. So even though the perfect solution to this is if everyone at all times could stay 6 feet separated from another person. But as you correctly mentioned, this is not always feasible. There are times when you have to do necessary functions. You have to get food. You have to get drugs from the pharmacy. And you might inadvertently be in a situation where you're close enough where that kind of transmission can take place. And importantly, I think what people don't fully appreciate is that putting a mask on yourself is more to prevent you from infecting someone else. And if everybody does that, we're each protecting each other, because the data is it's more efficient to prevent transmitting to others than it is to prevent transmission to yourself. But you can completely cover that ballpark if essentially universally, when people go out and are in a situation where they might come into closer contact, that they wear that mask. So we discussed this in detail yesterday, and in today's task force meeting, it will also be discussed in detail. So there may be recommendations coming out. They likely will be.
So in short, whatever the announcement today is about wearing masks, if people are to wear them, what's the guidance on under what circumstances and what kind of mask?
Okay, I'm glad you gave me the opportunity to address that, Judy, because the one thing that's paramount here that we want to make sure that people don't all of a sudden go out, buy and hoard masks that are most appropriately used and necessary for the frontline healthcare workers who do need it for the clear and present danger that they find themselves in when they are taking care of people who are actually sick with coronavirus disease. So we want to make sure that this issue of having a broader community approach towards putting on a facial covering doesn't in fact get in the way of the primary purpose of masks. And in that regard, that's why what we're talking about are things that may not necessarily need to be a classical mask, but could be some sort of facial covering. You know, we're pretty good in making things in a way that spontaneously becomes effective just because of your own creativity.
And the same question about masks that I was asking about staying at home, if these are things that save lives, keep people healthy, why not require them to do this?
You know, Judy, I understand where you're coming from, but it becomes difficult. When you say require, by what? By penalty? By putting people in jail? I mean, that becomes, you know, something that really can be counterproductive in the society that we live in America. Perhaps you might be able to do that in China, but I think it would be difficult to do it here. So what we're relying on is for people to really understand the importance of this.
And going back to what you said was new information about this organism, about how long it lingers in the air. People are asking, does it linger on the handle of a grocery bag? On a piece of paper. What is known about that at this time?
Yes. Well, studies actually have been done to determine the viable virus when you measure it on different surfaces like enamel, stainless steel, plastic, or cloth. It varies. It generally is measured in a few hours to, in some situations, maybe even a day or two. The titer of it may be so low that even though it's virus that's alive, it's not really capable of transmitting. The bottom line is there's a great deal of variability. One of the things one can do is when you have surfaces that you frequently touch, that you might get one of those alcohol swabs or one of the things that can disinfect and rub it off, clean it. That the most common one are doorknobs. And I think that's the thing that people should be most aware of, is because people who can get virus on their hands, one of the things you do every day is turn a doorknob. But I wouldn't fixate that the virus is going to hang around for weeks and months and you can't touch anything that's inanimate. That's really not the case. It generally is measured in a couple of hours to maybe a day or two. But when I say a day or two, I mean probably at a very low titer. The most important thing that I think overshadows all of that is to wash your hands as frequently as possible. I can tell you, Judy, I wash my hands 50 times a day. So rather than being concerned if a doorknob that I touch is contaminated, I'll just wash my hands as much as I possibly can. And when I don't have access to a sink and water and soap, I'll just carry around one of those Purell or alcohol things and clean it with that. Those are just some of the practical things that you can do.
Dr. Fauci, there are more reports we're hearing now from the heads of hospitals that they're worried about not having enough protective equipment, from doctors and nurses worried about equipment, about medications. On the other hand, the White House was saying last night that every place where something is needed, they're going to get it. What's the reality here?
Well, certainly everything that can possibly be done to make sure that no one anywhere in the United States will go without the necessary PPE or personal protective equipment, and certainly not ventilators. That is something that is right up there. It is very, very much on the awareness of the task force. FEMA is a major component and agency to see that we don't ever run into that situation where our brave healthcare workers are put more in harm's way by a lack of equipment. And that's what people concentrate on all the time. And hopefully we will never get into a situation where they'll fall short of that.
And on the question of social distancing and taking all the precautions we should, I just want to be clear. You're saying it's still too early to know when people can begin to relax on this.
You're absolutely correct. Thank you for asking that question. As I've said all the time, you can put into place a program where you would project that after a certain number of weeks, you start to see the bending and the turning of the curve. But the virus determines the timetable, not you or me in a predetermined timetable. We adjust the timetable as to what we see happening. And that's why I say what you need to look at first will be the first inkling is the number of new cases each day, the relative proportion. If that stabilizes, there's a cascading of events, because as the number of new cases begin to stabilize instead of exponentially going up, then the hospitalizations, then the intensive care, and then the deaths will stabilize. And what happens is there's always a lag. You're going to start seeing stabilization of new cases at the same time that you're seeing an increase in deaths. That may seem paradoxical, but it isn't, because after a while, the deaths catch up with it, and the early indications that something is going right will then ultimately be manifested in less deaths. So that's why what we look at, in New York, in New Orleans, in Chicago, in Detroit, as we start to see that stabilization, then we'll get a more comfortable feel for that we might be able to turn the corner. But right now, as I mentioned, we're in a very difficult period. It will get worse before it gets better. And I don't want the American public to get too alarmed at that. I mean, obviously it's concerning. It's not something to just put aside, but things will get better. They will turn around and we will get out of this.
I know you've said you don't like to look back, but I just have a couple of questions about where this originated. When did you first have a sense that this was different, that what had happened was not just another virus, that this one was going to be something more serious, much more serious?
Well, somewhere in the early January, when it became clear that what the Chinese had claimed originally, that this was just a virus that jumped from an animal reservoir to a human and wasn't being transmitted from human to human. Well, it became very clear pretty quickly that that was not the case, that this was a virus that was being transmitted from human to human. But not only that, you know, the nightmare that we have is that not only is it transmitted human to human, it does it very efficiently. And when the numbers started coming in as to what the morbidity and the mortality was, it was during that period in early to mid-January that it became clear to me that this was not just another SARS. It wasn't another MERS or Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. This was different.
I think you're aware of reporting that the Chinese were not transparent about all this in the very beginning. The question now that's arising, though, is people are asking, if they had been more transparent in the very beginning, would it have prevented the spread of this virus, period? Or would it have simply given more countries like the United States more time to prepare?
Well, Judy, I don't think anything would have prevented the spread of this virus. Once it emerged into society with its capability of efficient spread and morbidity and mortality, that was it. But what could have been different, and this is something that people are going to reflect on, you know, when this is all over, as they try and analyze what actually happened, is that if we had known that this was highly transmissible early on when it was just in China, I think other countries would have maybe been more quick on the trigger to try and inhibit travel from China to their country. Because remember, it started in China, and then China, by the fact that there are so many Chinese people and travel is part of our daily existence in this planet, that there would maybe have been more attention paid to the possibility that just pure travel from China in general, but certainly from Wuhan and the Hubei district, is something that could start an outbreak throughout the world. So that delay in transparency, I think, likely had an impact on what I just said, the awareness that this could seed the rest of the world.
All that points right back to Chinese officials, doesn't it?
Looks that way.
And I want to be careful about how I ask you this, but there are reports that there have been threats made against you, that security around you has been increased. And the question I have is this job more than you thought it would be? Is it now something more than you bargained for?
You know, Judy, as I've said often, this is the life that I've chosen, and I accept it. It is what it is. The thing that I don't like is the effect that it has on my family.
Well, we know you are working around the clock, and the country is very grateful. Dr. Anthony Fauci, thank you very much.
Thank you, Judy. Very good to be with you.
In the day's other news, the combination of huge job losses in March and surging coronavirus deaths sent Wall Street tumbling again. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 360 points to close at 21,052. The NASDAQ fell 114 points, and the S&P 500 gave up 38. In the presidential campaign, Wisconsin's governor moved to stop next Tuesday's primary, citing COVID-19. Democrat Tony Evers called state lawmakers to convene tomorrow in a special session. He said he wants to switch to an all-mail-in primary and let everyone vote by absentee through May 26. But Republican legislative leaders refused and said the primary should be held as planned. Authorities in Maryland spent this day searching the Chesapeake Bay for a granddaughter and great-grandson of the late Robert F. Kennedy. They were looking for Maeve Kennedy Townsend McCain and her 8-year-old son. The pair were in a canoe Thursday afternoon when strong winds came up. An overturned canoe matching the missing one was found last night. A leading African-American artist, David Driskell, has died after contracting the coronavirus. He was also an author and an authority in his field, and his own work was often inspired by the landscape at his home in Maine. David Driskell was 88 years old. And singer-songwriter Bill Withers, a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, has died from heart complications in Los Angeles. He had a string of soulful hits in the 1970s, including Lean On Me, Ain't No Sunshine, and Lovely Day. Here he is performing Lean On Me in 1974.
We all need somebody to lean.
The song has become an anthem for healthcare workers and others during the coronavirus pandemic. Bill Withers was 81 years old. Still to come on the NewsHour, speaking with Senator Chuck Schumer on efforts to help the economic downturn across the country. Retired doctors head back to the front lines in the fight against COVID-19. Plus, Mark Shields and David Brooks on another week in a changed America.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
As millions of Americans find themselves unemployed and worrying about how to pay their bills, Lisa Desjardins looks at how well state and local governments are doing at getting out the trillions in aid passed by Congress last week.
That $2 trillion rescue bill became law 1 week ago today, and now states are racing to try and set up those increased unemployment payments even as layoffs grow by as much as 1 million people each day. For that and for more on what's next, I'm joined by Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York. Of course, that is one of the states hardest hit by this pandemic. Thank you so much for joining us, Leader Schumer. My first question for you is about that unemployment increase. You know, it's complicated because each state runs its own system, and now the federal government must sign off and kind of make sure that that flows. What can you tell people who are losing jobs right now about when you think they will see that increased benefit?
Well, we have demanded, Senator Wyden and myself, that the checks reach people in 2 weeks. We provided $1 billion to help the states augment their unemployment offices. We want to make sure that when people call in, that they can get the $600 augmentation of their pay, of their salary, of their unemployment benefits immediately. And we have made it much simpler for people to apply. It's a one-sheet testification because we want to get the money out quickly. And it applies to all kinds of people who never got unemployment. Part-time people, gig workers, freelancers, individual people. And so we are urging very strongly the administration to make sure that the state offices are up to snuff. I've been talking to my state, New York, and they expect to be ready and willing to go quite soon. We need the other states to do that as well because, A, people need these paychecks. They need it for rent, groceries, and everything else. And B, we need to pump some money into the economy quickly or it'll just crash.
You know, I'm going to come back to New York in a second, but you're one of the four top leaders in Congress. Why wasn't this nation and why wasn't New York better prepared for this?
Well, the nation wasn't better prepared because, frankly, I think President Trump was behind the curve. He first said it was a hoax. He then said, don't take it seriously. The testing was way behind the curve. I called for a national emergency on January 26th. But not much happened. And even on things like the supplies that our frontline workers need, the PPEs, the masks, they still, today I asked the president once again to use the Defense Production Act and hire and put in place a general, a military person who knows logistics, who knows command and control, to take control of both the manufacture of these needed materials and the distribution. We just had a conference call with our 47 Democratic senators. Across the country, hospitals workers are scrambling to find these things on their own. The DPA, the Defense Production Act, allows the federal government to come in, commandeer factories, commandeer supply lines, and put the supplies in the places they're most needed. I spoke to five hospital leaders today. They're desperate for this. They're spending a quarter of their time hunting and pecking to try and find the materials they need. So we need this administration to implement what Congress has put in much better, whether it's unemployment insurance, small business loans, or distributing the greatly needed PPEs, masks, ventilators that are maldistributed across the country.
Senator, is that what should happen next, is sort of focus on expanding what's already been passed? What should happen next? And is your state of New York getting enough? Your governor has been critical in some ways of what Congress passed.
We are not getting enough. We have done pretty well. I mean, the New York State will get over $110 billion to our unemployed people, to our small businesses, to our hospitals. But this crisis is looking bigger and bigger and bigger. And I think that in the next COVID-4 bill, we're not only going to have to probably expand some of the programs we put in place, but we're going to have to look at bolder things. Since I've been home, I've been hearing from people who know how the economy works that if we don't move quickly and boldly, the recession could become a depression and it could last much longer than any of us would want. So the bold, quick action that we did take in the Senate, 96-0, in the most extensive program of government help for people who need help since the Great Society, has to be replicated and maybe even expanded, and rather soon, I'd say before the end of April.
Senator Schumer, briefly, you know, I know that you've been speaking to the president repeatedly, but at the same time, he sent a letter to you last night criticizing you. He wrote specifically that if you had spent less time on what he calls an impeachment hoax, New York would not be so unprepared. How do you come together, and do you advise him on things like whether he should put out a national stay-at-home order?
Look, I've talked to the president five or six times. I ignore those kinds of things that you just did. They're beside the point. We all have to roll up our sleeves, come together, and do what is needed. And that's where the focus has got to be. And the president has to lead. He has to lead. And leading means getting hold of this problem and implementing the good law that Democrats and Republicans passed in Congress. And I hope he will do that on Defense Production Act. I hope he will do that on unemployment insurance, make sure it's out in 2 weeks. I'd like to see that we give extra pay to the frontline workers who are needed to come to the front lines because they're risking their lives and everything like that. I think we'll put that in COVID-4, but the president could do it for federal workers right now. There are a whole bunch of things he can do, following up on our legislation and on his own, to deal with the magnitude and depth of this crisis.
Thank you, Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, speaking from your Brooklyn apartment. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Nice to see you again, Lisa.
As the pandemic spreads, state officials are sounding the alarm that not enough doctors and nurses are available to meet the growing needs of patients. That has meant an all-hands-on-deck approach in some parts of the country. Rules and regulations are now being lifted or changed to allow medical students to graduate early and to enable retired doctors to return to the profession. We heard from many of them, and Lisa is with us again to tell their stories.
This week, desperate pleas for medical reinforcements went out from many of the nation's governors.
Administrators, doctors, nurses, we are calling on you to step up and step in and meet this moment.
We need to have folks who are willing to come return to service.
If you don't have a health care crisis in your community, please come help us in New York now.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said 1 million additional healthcare professionals would soon be needed there, a state that has become the epicenter of the pandemic in the U.S.
I'm volunteering because this is the way that I can continue to give back, you know, to New York City. I'm a lifelong New Yorker.
Dr. Jane Bedell spent years treating sick patients during the AIDS crisis and for several decades was a primary care physician and public health official in the Bronx. She retired in February and was set for a trip to Wyoming with her son this week.
I had planned kind of a very unstructured, kind of lackadaisical approach to retirement, honestly.
But 2 weeks ago, the 63-year-old scrapped those plans and instead signed up for the New York City Medical Reserve Corps.
I feel compelled, even in retirement, to step a little bit forward in this moment and to give back in whatever small way that I can and to join with my city in this response.
Another potential source of help, immigrant doctors. Some states like New York and New Jersey are granting immigrant doctors who fall short of some requirements temporary licenses. The Migration Policy Institute estimates some 165,000 health workers who were foreign-born have skills that aren't fully utilized because of rules requiring them to relicense or retrain. And in states with some of the highest numbers of cases, medical schools are now rushing to graduate students early and assigning them to hospitals most in need.
I just virtually graduated from medical school.
On Tuesday, Lauren Caldwell became a doctor while sitting in front of a computer for the University of Massachusetts Medical School's entirely online graduation. She missed the chance to walk across the stage in a cap and gown, but her training will be put to immediate use in one of the university's healthcare facilities.
I'm full of emotions. I don't know if I should be excited, happy.
This definitely isn't how I imagined it, but I'm really excited.
Dr. Taylor Shortsleeve is one of Caldwell's classmates. He feels both enthusiasm and uncertainty right now.
My mom's an NP, and she does primary care. She's particularly worried about me because, the mother-son relationship, she doesn't want me to come down with the coronavirus. I had asthma as a kid, so I'm a little worried myself. But other than that, I kind of quell everyone's fears by saying, we're going to be protected, and this is my calling. This is what I want to do.
Newly graduated doctors likely won't see the most critically ill patients, but some other young doctors are already in the thick of it and are being put to the test.
Nobody ever thinks that they're going to go into residency and get hit, by a pandemic.
Reyna Gonzalez came to New York from Puerto Rico 2 years ago to start her residency in internal medicine at Mount Sinai Beth Israel Hospital.
I've been receiving a lot of these patients. It's really tough because they come really short of breath. They really say, I can't breathe. I can't control this fever. Being with that first patient, when I'm like, I really want to help you, but at the same time, I don't know what you have. I don't know how this can affect me, my life, my loved ones. It's the uncertainty, not knowing. We're doctors, we're researchers, we're scientists. We're used to knowing, having the answers. And not knowing, it's something we're not used to, at least I'm not used to.
For older doctors like Dr. Bedell, some of the personal risks are even higher, especially since she's a recent cancer survivor with hypertension.
My family put a lot of work into my recovery, for which I am forever thankful, and my neighbors and my friends, and this might just piss them off if I got sick.
That's why some have questioned whether it's prudent for retired doctors to come back. Dr. Bedell says she'll likely not be assigned to high-risk jobs, but instead offer support to take pressure off of other doctors.
I don't want to clog up an emergency room spot or a hospital bed or, oh my goodness, no, do not have anyone on a ventilator that you could have prevented from using that unbelievable, valuable resource.
These will be our first days and weeks as doctors.
But for graduating students like Columbia's Maggie Bogardis, the crisis offers a unique opportunity. And she says she's grateful to serve in this moment.
What I'm going to take with me is how much it's brought people, specifically in the health world, together. I have been seeing and hearing really incredible things and unprecedented things in terms of what people are willing to do and how they're willing to help. That's why we're here and that's why we're doing what we're doing. I think it's a really poignant reminder as we're starting off on our careers.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Lisa Desjardins.
And now we turn to the analysis of Shields and Brooks. That is syndicated columnist Mark Shields and New York Times columnist David Brooks. Hello to both of you. We are keeping our distance from one another, as we know we absolutely have to do. When we were together the last time, the three of us, it was 2 weeks ago, and at that point there were 15,000 coronavirus cases in this country. 200 deaths have been recorded. 2 weeks later, it's 270,000 deaths and 270,000 cases, 7,000 deaths. How are we doing as a country, David, in getting our arms around this?
Yeah, and in 2 weeks, we could be seeing another higher shoot up in those lines. You know, I don't think we can say things are confidently being handled. What's happening to the Comfort, the naval medical ship in New York State, is something of a regulatory travesty. The fact that tests are a third, some of them are failing by a third, positive, negatives, positive, or false positives, false negatives. Some of the uniforms and supplies are still not getting to New York State. So it does not look like we have mobilized the way you would think a country with a first-class defense department or a first-class set of bureaucracies would mobilize. And so it's worrisome. Take aside from all the politics, it just doesn't seem like competence.
Mark, what does it look like to you?
Well, I don't disagree, but I would add that, that at least there's a consensus now, if not unanimity, that this is a serious, grave national calamity. The president's moving on it, I think, has made a difference, and he's brought with him the folks at Fox News, who bring with them a very large chunk. There's no longer any body in the country that argues that this is some sort of a Democratic hoax to jeopardize the president's reelection. But there has not been that assumption of national leadership, at least of a constant and consistent manner. That I think remains a problem. And just last night, Judy, Ms. Blackthorne, I think her name was, Blackstrom, who in New York, who had been laid off and had 300 calls to the Labor Department unemployment to qualify for unemployment insurance. And, you know, that's just unforgivable. And this is a time when all hands have to be on deck, that everybody, this is not a question of bailing out industries. It's a question of saving families and individuals.
David, and the approach from the White House has been, this is something that state by state, we need the states to make decisions, for example, about whether people should be asked or urged to stay at home. Today, the announcement about wearing masks, the president said, that's up to individuals. I don't plan to do it. Is the president right to be leaving these decisions up to individuals and up to states?
I do agree with what Tony Fauci said about that. I do think the idea of ordering people to do things in sort of some dictatorial fashion will set off a reaction that'll be a counter reaction. I think the right thing for the president to do is to say, here's what's right, project a tone of here's what we're going to do, wise governors follow along. And that is slowly happening with 80% of the country under social distancing. And so I'm a little hesitant to think that you can just order by diktat all sorts of personal things. I think telling people what's smart, and so far the American people, I have to say, are taking this seriously. Most are social distancing. Most are rallying around each other to an astonishing degree. I think morale is astonishingly high given what's happening. So I think just ordering Americans around is not always the right strategy.
Mark, what about that approach of saying this is something that individuals and frankly state and local leaders need to make for themselves?
Well, this is a perfect example of a president, a national leader, leading by example. And the president is leading by his example, which is not to subscribe to the edict or the suggestion or the recommendation. And I just think, you know, having watched Tony Fauci, I will say this, that he is a remarkable public servant. He speaks truth to power. He did the same thing with President Ronald Reagan some 35 years ago at the HIV threat, and said that this is a serious threat to the nation and to its national health. He is consistently, presidents do not like to be corrected or contradicted, this president less than any. And he has done so in an effective way, whether it's putting the correction on that there is no vaccine right around the corner, that we're going to be back to normal. And I just think he deserves enormous credit. And Donald Trump surprises me because he does not tolerate correction or contradiction. And the fact that Tony Fauci is still there is an indication, I think, to his indispensability.
And David, when it comes to the economy, when it comes to people's livelihoods, I mean, we now have, 10 million Americans and rising who are seeking unemployment benefits. Businesses are going out of business by the hundreds and by the thousands. What about the administration's approach to keeping the economy afloat?
Well, here there's a lot of blame to go along. I would say that when we look at the bill that was passed by Congress a couple of weeks ago, the stimulus bill, we'll regard it as one of the worst economic packages maybe in American history, certainly in a time of crisis. What they're doing in Europe is they're preserving the businesses. They're keeping people employed. They're just paying businesses to say, we're going to give you some money, but you're going to keep your payroll. So people don't have the threat of unemployment. They don't have the insecurity of unemployment. They don't have the possibility they'll never get a job again or they won't get a job for a long time. They just sort of freeze the economy. And we didn't do that. We took a more individualistic approach. We'll just give you $1,200. We had a backstop measure, which is $350 billion for businesses. We should increase that to $600 billion, $700 billion, so businesses can keep their payroll. And there's a lot of blame to go around. The Democrats took this option because they didn't want to be seen to be bailing out business. The Republicans, I'm not sure they had a coherent thought in their heads. And so this is, I think, a catastrophic error, which we should just be fixing very quickly.
And Mark, how do you size up the economic, the approach to the economy, the approach to saving Americans who are seeing, in some cases, everything they have disappearing?
No, I think, Judy, and I disagree here, I think the immediate object of help and assistance has to be people, individuals, and they are the ones, the families to be fed, just to be held together. And putting money into their pockets through unemployment insurance, through the federal grant, I think is urgent and compelling. But as I come back to, this is a time when government has to respond and provide particularly unemployment insurance. People calling 3 or 4 days to even get registered is just unacceptable and unforgivable.
And go ahead, David.
No, I was just going to say, you know, it's better to have them not unemployed. I mean, there are going to be some people who are unemployed, and for them, certainly the unemployment insurance is there. But if you could sit at home knowing that you had a job and knowing that you were getting paid for that job, even though you were sitting at home, and that you were probably going to go back to that job, that seems to me the right way to do this. And I understand culturally why we didn't do it. I understand politically why bailing out business seemed to be a bad thing, but it's fixable. And when Chuck Schumer said earlier in the program that he wants something else, I would hope this would be the something else we would do before the end of April.
And Mark, we're told they're going to come back at some point in the coming weeks with a bigger aid package.
No question. I think that that is coming. And I have to say that the president showed an absence of leadership at the signing of that rescue bill, the aid bill to save the American families who are besieged by this terrible calamity, not to invite a single Democrat to the signing at a time when he's saying this is not a time for politics, was not the kind of example that we need. We're going to have another bill, a major bill, it's a time of the greatest urgency.
Just in 20 seconds or so, David, bipartisanship. Do you see a hope for it in coming weeks and months?
Well, I'd see a hope that we're going to learn the lessons here, that we're going to learn that being competent matters, that we're going to learn that politics is not a reality game show. We're going to learn that sometimes insiders like Anthony Fauci are the ones we trust the most.
Well, we thank the both of you, David Brooks, Mark Shields, and please stay safe. Thank you.
Thank you, Judy.
Returning now to the question of wearing masks, how effective they are, and whether homemade masks can help stop the spread of the virus. We want to look at what is motivating the small army of citizens making masks in their own communities. Jeffrey Brown focuses on one Washington, D.C. suburb. It's Bethesda, Maryland, where locals have put sewing machines to work to make different types of masks for local medical professionals. It's part of our ongoing arts and culture series, Canvas.
Fiber artist Anya Caldwell is used to creating handmade products. She knits, crochets, weaves, and sews. Now she's using any fabric she has, as well as donated linens, dish towels, and pajamas for a new purpose.
A personal message to the people out there that are obviously stressed having to do this right now, that we care for them, we love them. Neighbors donated a fabric that 37 years ago were the curtains in their baby's nursery. So they had sentimental value.
Caldwell has produced more than 200 fabric masks herself and is also working with families to make almost 200 more. They've received design advice from local healthcare workers. Some nurses and doctors around the country are welcoming the handmade masks as hospital-supplied surgical masks are depleted. Jennifer Sun, a pediatrician by training, follows a do-it-yourself pattern recommended online that allows a filter to be inserted as an additional protective layer.
There was a Facebook group that formed that has now over 5,000 members to send a message to people who are in charge that they need to get better protective equipment for our healthcare providers.
The need to contribute amid so much uncertainty is motivating people all over. A sailmaker in Maine.
I'm with you. I hear you.
A fashion designer in South Carolina, workers at a jeans company in Mississippi. Back in Bethesda, Rodolfo Castro, his wife Lisa, and kids felt that same need.
We hope that these masks can lend a little more protection or extend the life of the N95 masks that nurses and doctors are wearing.
High school junior Grace McGuire uses bright fabrics collected over the years on visits to her grandmother in Hawaii. She aims to make 100 masks, some for community members.
It's also therapeutic, and it's a good like way to make me feel productive because I'm helping people in my community have like safer masks, so they're not buying these medical masks that the hospitals need.
Lawyers Gary and Janet McDavid have built what they call an assembly line in their basement. Along with neighbors, they have completed hundreds of CDC-compliant homemade surgical masks.
When we're finished, we take them to the hospital, we call, and they send someone out to collect the masks.
Maria Monteverdi Jackson says the handiwork has multiple purposes.
Of course I believe in the power of small groups in times of crisis. I mean, the world needs big heroes right now, but we also need small heroes. And I suppose our greatest hope is that, in a small way, these masks help them to come home to their friends and family when this is all over, and to be able to give them a great big hug, because we could all use a great big hug right now.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
We sure could, and we thank every single one of them and every one of you who are doing this for what you are doing. Thank you. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Have a great weekend. Thank you. Please stay safe, and good night.